This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new report finds that most countries do not meet the World Health Organization's standard for fine particulate matter, which is the most deadly form of air pollution. The report included 134 countries and territories. Only 7 met those standards in a review of 2023 data by the Swiss company IQ Air. Wisconsin shows up in the study not in a good way. Beloit, for some reason, appeared with the highest levels of particulates in the U.S. The most polluted major U.S. city is also in the Midwest, Columbus, Ohio. So is this a problem that can be solved? What does it all mean for our health? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or someone in your family have asthma or other respiratory illness where air quality is a really important issue for you? Are you worried about air pollution? How has it affected your life? Do you want to see changes in the way it's regulated? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Gage Kerr is a senior research scientist at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University. Gage grew up in Wisconsin. Gage, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
First of all, what is fine particulate matter and why do we worry about it?
Fine particulate matter, which I'll try to always say, but in the event I abbreviate it, it's abbreviated PM2.5, and it's a pollutant that's very common throughout urban areas and even rural areas. It's kind of a catch-all term. Many different components or species can be considered fine particulate matter. So it's almost like saying, I'm having a cookie, right? We don't know if it's an Oreo, if it's grandma's homemade cookie, or what kind of cookie it is. And in the same vein, particulate matter can be comprised of pollution that comes from, say, a car's exhaust. It could also be coming from agriculture or even natural sources like dust and sea salt.
The concern, I guess, is this is stuff that our lungs don't want, whatever the source. What kind of health impact does it have?
Yes, you are correct. Studies time and time again have demonstrated this very pronounced and robust link between particulate matter exposure and a number of adverse health outcomes. Some of those health outcomes are admittedly not as serious as others. So particulate matter, for example, can lead to respiratory infections, asthma exacerbations. So I'm not trying to downplay those, of course, but on the flip side of the spectrum, you have a lot of research that's shown that prolonged exposure to particulate matter can lead to premature death.
This new report out, now this is one company looking at monitoring data around the world. They acknowledge there are some gaps. Not every place is measuring this well enough. But the big takeaway, this is a problem in many, if not most, places on our planet. Why do we do so poorly?
Well, we humans like to burn fossil fuels, right? We need fossil fuels, at least currently, to power our homes, businesses, to drive cars. And unfortunately, a byproduct of fossil fuel combustion is pollution. So this, at the end of the day, just traces back to our consumption of fossil fuels. Now, there are some particulate matter sources that are beyond just fossil fuel combustion. So particulate matter, I didn't mention this before, but it can also arise from things like wildfires, which we know are increasing in a rapidly warming world. So at the end of the day, again, this ubiquitous or very common particulate matter throughout global cities can be traced back to largely fossil fuel consumption.
There are different standards at play. This used the World Health Organization guideline, which I believe is 5 micrograms of fine particulate matter, I think, per year. Correct me if I have it wrong. Here in the U.S., our EPA guidelines, not 5, but 12, but considering bringing it down to 9. What do you make of those differing standards here in the U.S. versus the World Health Organization?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I think part of the difference in the World Health Organization's versus our EPA standards, we can think about in the context of what they represent. So the World Health Organization has guidelines, right? They're not legally binding their guidelines. And as a result of those guidelines and the scientists who have worked behind the scenes to produce them, that team of individuals has concluded that we should really aim for 5 micrograms. It's per cubic meter,
right,
which is kind of an obscure unit. In the U.S., we have standards, and they are enforced by the EPA, so they have a little bit more teeth to them. They're legally binding in some senses. So the standards reflect what is maybe more feasible to achieve or attain. So it's not that one is right or one is wrong. It more comes down to what is actually possible and what can we, and by we, I'm talking about the EPA and enforcement agencies, what can we actually attain in a certain jurisdiction?
How much control can a local jurisdiction have over this? We might be able to say, okay, this particulate matters from that highway over there or that coal power plant over here. But as you mentioned, it might be from a wildfire in another country thousands of miles to the west. Do we control our own destiny that well when it comes to this kind of pollution?
I'll give you maybe a politician answer, yes and no. In some senses, yes. If we were to shut off, let's say, cars and factories in city X or Y, there would be immediate local decreases in air pollution. But you're right in that lots of our air pollution is transported by the atmosphere. So wind and pressure differences, meteorology, allow pollution to be transported oftentimes hundreds, maybe even thousands of miles away from where it's emitted. So I think this underscores that air is a shared resource, right? Unlike some other things, whether it be our own land or maybe our water, where there are kind of clear boundaries or watersheds, air is, again, a shared resource. And as we think about controlling pollution, I think it's important to think about that aspect of air. And in the U.S. in particular, there are some things that people refer to as good neighbor clauses, right? That states downwind of a particular state are going to bear the consequences of air pollution in an upwind state. So we should be coordinating across states, across jurisdictions to try to do mitigation strategies and air pollution reduction strategies in concert with one another.
Talking to senior research scientist Gage Kerr at George Washington University about air quality, a new international report finds almost all countries around the world have concerning levels of particulate matter in their air, at least some of the time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Gage, I wanted to ask about some of your work on who is affected the most by various kinds of air pollution. Obviously, air can go anywhere, but the health impacts are not necessarily evenly distributed. Who tends to suffer the worst consequences?
In my research, I largely focus on the U.S. and what research that I've led, along with research that countless others have pioneered, has shown is that, unfortunately, marginalized groups in the U.S. face the highest levels of air pollution and associated health damages. So when I say marginalized groups, I'm talking about communities that have low wealth or low socioeconomic status, as well as Black and Brown communities. And this co-location of marginalization and higher pollution is rooted, unfortunately, in history. Perhaps some listeners have heard of redlining and other racist land use practices and zoning practices that occurred many decades ago, but they still have real-world consequences for how air pollution is distributed within our cities and within our country.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ruth is with us in Milwaukee. Ruth, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Ruth?
I'm going to read a poem that I wrote about air.
Okay, go ahead.
The air we breathe. Ah, air is so good and so fresh. But sometimes the air we breathe is toxic. Some people struggle to breathe. Toxic air is like an electric collar. It chokes you. Why does this happen? Three words: climate change, global warming, and humans. The last one probably shocks you. But yes, humans pollute Mother Earth's air. Would she be better off without us? That's a question I ponder about. Some people say that they believe we fight for clean air, but they don't really know what it means. They procrastinate and put profit over our well-being. They know that Mother Earth's clean air is in danger, but they don't want to help. Does that even make sense to you? It doesn't to me.
Ruth, thank you for reading that. Can I ask Ruth how old you are?
I'm 11 years old.
All right. Ruth, thank you for calling in and sharing your poem about clean air. Gage, stepping outside of the research into the humanities there, but did Ruth capture, you think, some of the causes and concerns about what you're researching?
Yeah, for sure. I don't know if you're still on, Ruth, but hi. Thanks for sharing that poem. That was lovely. I agree with the poem and the sentiment behind it. I think it's important to remember, too, that while it's easy to maybe get depressed or sad about air pollution and toxic pollution, you know, you mentioned something that you wonder if Mother Earth is better off without us. I might have gotten that quote wrong, but I think what we have to remember is that we have solutions and they're not pie in the sky. We still need to research them for decades. Solutions, they're solutions that we have at our disposal now that if we implemented them, we could see really immediate and important decreases in air quality. So I hope that people like you, Ruth, and you know your classmates and friends can grow up to be advocates for clean air and a healthier environment for all people.
Ruth, thanks again for sharing that with us. We're talking to Gage Kerr, senior research scientist at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University, looking at a new report finding that most countries do not meet the World Health Organization standards for fine particulate matter. United States does not. Our standards are a little different. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the U.S. should have stricter standards for air pollution? Do you have questions for our guest about research on this issue? Do you see concerns in your community about racial disparities, socioeconomic disparities in how people are exposed to air pollution? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Gage Kerr, senior research scientist at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University, looking at a report finding that most countries around the world, including the U.S., don't meet a key World Health Organization benchmark when it comes to clean air. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about how air pollution affects our health? What can be done to mitigate some of those problems? Is this a particular concern for you or someone in your family? Are you vulnerable when we have bad air days? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Gage, in answering Ruth's poem there, you talked about solutions that we know, and you've started to touch on them a little bit. Talk about some of the things we could do to cut back, especially on this particulate matter in our air.
I think the answer depends exactly where you live. Maybe I'll first start by talking about urban areas, then we can talk about rural areas too. In urban areas, a lot of this fine particulate matter comes from traffic and from industry. And there are many solutions that we have at our fingertips to reduce pollution from these sources. Things like active transit, so walking, riding your bike, are some ways to reduce fine particulate matter. Also, increased public transit would be another way to reduce fine particulate matter. But having grown up in rural Wisconsin, I understand that a small unincorporated town is not going to put in a metro system or light rail, obviously. So there are some other ways that we can be cognizant of ways of life and culture to get at this common goal that we should all have of making the air healthier for everyone. So in rural areas, we can maybe think about energy sources. I know that wood burning is quite common in rural Wisconsin. And on one hand, wood burning is great because it, in theory, reduces fossil fuel consumption that folks otherwise might be using natural gas or coal or oil to heat their homes. But wood burning has its own issues associated with it, mainly air pollution. So it'd be great moving forward if we could move towards more sustainable forms of heating our homes and powering our homes. Maybe solar panels, wind, et cetera.
Let's talk a little bit about other forms of air pollution. When, you know, during wildfire season, when I've been obsessively monitoring air quality, there's always the listing for particulate matter and then for ozone levels. And that's caused by companies and things like that don't release ozone directly, I understand, but chemicals that lead to ozone creation. How big a concern is that? How well are we doing at trying to control it?
Yeah, ozone, as you mentioned, is an interesting pollutant. The ingredients to make ozone are emitted oftentimes in cities, but oftentimes we find the highest ozone concentrations in suburban or even rural areas because ozone chemistry takes time and space in our atmosphere. So you asked how we're doing with ozone. Thankfully, in much of the US, our ozone standards set by the EPA to protect public health are being met. So that's good news. Still, though, we as epidemiologists and environmental health scientists have detected impacts that ozone has on public health, even at concentrations or levels below the EPA standards. So there's more work that we could be doing to reduce pollution that leads to ozone formation. And a lot of those solutions also trace back to some of the solutions I mentioned a few minutes ago regarding traffic and industry.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Rich is with us now in Two Rivers. Rich, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on. Hey, I was kind of curious. I grew up in New York City in the 60s as a kid and the 70s, and I saw the transition the government made with doing away with the leaded gas and catalytic converters. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some of the changes that the government has made in other instances regarding pollution controls. And some of them, they went back on their word and they went back on the law. My question is, in today's political atmosphere, would changes that have been made back then, such as catalytic converters, if it would have cost big corporations money, would they have elected to go otherwise than what the decision they made for our health and for the environment?
Rich, thanks for the call. Gage, I've seen the examples he gave, ending leaded gas, catalytic converters, also efforts to deal with the hole in the ozone layer as success stories of cooperation and regulation in the past. Is that era over? I think Rich is kind of asking.
Yeah, well, let me start this by saying this gets out of my area of expertise and research, but thanks for your question, Rich. I think what you described underscores to me the importance of really robust top-down regulations. The purpose, in my opinion, of a company or corporation is to maximize profit, right? I know that sometimes gets demonized, but at the end of the day, companies want to make a profit, and that's fine. I think what that means, though, is that as a society, we should have rules on how they go about making profit, and they cannot make profit at the expense of harming human health. So I'm not exactly sure if some of the really positive actions that happened back in the 60s, 70s, even 80s would happen now. But again, I think this underscores to me the importance of having these kind of checks and balances from the government where, yes, you can go about your business, you can make money, but you have to do so in a way that protects the air we breathe and the health of those who breathe it.
Thanks, Rich, for that call. We are talking to Gage Kerr from George Washington University, senior research scientist in public health, looking at air pollution. Big study finds that most countries are not meeting at least World Health Organization standards when it comes to particulate matter. Back to your calls now. Silas is with us in Green Bay. Silas, hi. Silas, are you there?
Correct.
Yeah, Silas, what did you want to tell us about?
Many companies have decided to use plastics and other things that can pollute and hurt a lot of communities, but not everybody can actually afford other fresh produce and healthier things. Yet, when they produce these cheap plastics, it can pollute. Like, factories can pollute the air, and companies sometimes try to take advantage over people who don't have as much money.
Silas, can I ask how old you are, Silas?
I am 9 years old.
Nine. Okay, the youth coming out big time for Central Time today. Thanks for calling in, Silas. Silas mentioned plastics production, Gage. How big a factor is that in air pollution?
Yeah, well, first, thank you, Silas, for sharing those thoughts. It's great to have so much youth input on this call. Generally, scientists think about plastic pollution a little bit differently than air pollution, but what is common between those two forms of pollution is that they can have consequences on health and ecosystems. And sometimes these pollutants, even though they're different, can come from the same sources. For example, I think Silas mentioned factories. Factories can pollute the air, right? But they can also pollute the water and have waste runoff. So I think this stresses the importance of thinking holistically, that air pollution doesn't exist in isolation, soil pollution doesn't exist in isolation, but all these environmental contaminants can co-occur.
And Silas also points us towards something we talked about earlier, Gage, the uneven impact. Lower income people may not be able to afford to move out of that high pollution area. If there are filters and mitigation, things that might help with particular kinds of pollution, they might not be able to afford that. That points back to your research on the unequal impacts. Can you talk about that a bit more in just our last minute?
Sure. I think I'll maybe rephrase this. Instead of talking about unequal impacts, I think it's cool to talk about opportunities too. And in this sense, I'm really excited that some of the recent measures put forth by the Biden-Harris administration have been cognizant of these income and socioeconomic differences. So there are opportunities now for communities of low wealth to have greater access to monitors, to monitor the air they breathe, and have greater accesses to resources to try to mitigate or reduce pollution. And so that gives me hope that even though there are these really stark differences in income and access to commodities, that the government's cognizant of them and doing things to try to even the playing field to make sure that everyone is not just breathing clean air, but has access to things like electric cars and heat pumps to try to reduce air pollution.
Silas, thanks for that call. And Gage, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Gage Kerr is a senior research scientist at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University. He talked to us about new research finding that most places in the world don't meet a key benchmark for clean air.